Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching, a weekly television podcast from Vanity Fair. I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Chris Murphy. We are here to discuss the fourth episode of the HBO series The White Lotus in the Sandbox, which sees new fun pairings of characters down at the beach and introduces a new version of the theme song, a folksy, sort of banjo-heavy, acoustic version of the theme song that I'm fully obsessed with.
This song can really go in any direction it wants.
So many interpolations. Later, I'll talk to Haley Lou Richardson about heading to Casa Amor with Red Trunks' boy from Essex, Jack.
I definitely think Jack is like the opposite of Albie, obviously. Yeah, it's just, but I also think that shows just like how not grounded and kind of self-serving like Portia's true mindset is right now.
There's also the ongoing and all-important question of who winds up dead at the end of the show, which definitely got a lot more interesting in this episode. I think the theorizing did. Chris and I are going to debate who we think is dead, and we'll also fold in your theories about who winds up floating in the Mediterranean. And we're going to keep track of whichever one, you know, maybe was the most right, I guess.
Yes.
And whoever wins gets an Aperol spritz. Yum, yum.
Yum, yum. He can't wait.
So, Chris, let's just cut to the chase at the start of this episode and talk about the most interesting new character, Quentin, played by Tom Hollander, who finally, I mean, I think we have our suspicions about Valentina, but Quentin is unquestionably gay.
Undoubtedly gay, LGBTQ plus, and we love to see it.
And he, like many a gay man in the real world, worships Jennifer Coolidge / Tanya. Although, given that this is The White Lotus, is Quentin good or bad?
Is anyone good or bad?
Well, right. Okay, sure.
We could go down. I like Tanya. I tell my whole life story.
Quentin genuinely think that Tanya is fabulous and has good taste?
I honestly think, knowing Mike White and knowing that he is very attuned to, I think, conversations about The White Lotus and how gay men act in society and how obsessed many queer men and queer people and gay people are with Jennifer Coolidge, I think he's doing a little bit of a play on the internet frenzy and all the love that's being shown on Jennifer Coolidge.
Yeah.
There are we know so many gay men whose total personality is just loving character actresses. Like, that's such a real thing. And I think Quentin is a little bit of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge comment on that phenomenon that is happening to Jennifer Coolidge in real life.
So he's just an angel who has arrived in sad, lonely Tanya's life to validate her.
I really like those guys. Don't you? If you're looking for a friend, gay guys are really the best. Because, let's face it, women are kind of depressing.
Oh. You think?
Yeah, I think most women are drips. But it's not their fault. They have a lot to be depressed about. But, you know, they are not fun. These gay guys are fun.
It feels like it's maybe a new discovery for her, which you'd think someone like her
would know already.
Would have already had that experience, but maybe not.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because it seems like she's spent so much of her life going after male validation, straight male validation, that it could totally right. pass her mind that, wait, actually, I play really well with the gays.
yeah, exactly. I'm a hit. I think the one thing that has me nervous is that, A, well, it's the White Lotus.
Yes.
B, nothing good really happens to Tanya. Even her marriage, it wasn't good. And C, do you remember in episode 2, Cameron is talking to, you know, his group, and he's talking about these rich Europeans who have these villas, but actually they have no money.
Yes.
And here we have now mention of a villa in Ez and a villa in Palermo. And it's like, wait, these are Europeans who have villas. Does that mean they have no money? And so, and they know, maybe they know Tanya does.
And maybe they know that Tanya does. And you know what also scares me, back to Quentin, is the story that he told Tanya about the woman who lived on the cliff in the beautiful
right.
house.
Uh-huh.
Who then winds up face down in the ocean because she yeah. won't sell her property. And that's where they're going, right? They're
right.
going to that villa that's now public property, which is maybe for the greater good, he even says.
Right, right. You know, and there's also Jack to be considered here, who is
I'm always considering
Quentin's
Jack.
Nephew. Yeah, right. He was very hunky Love Island. He's from Essex, which is perfect.
Chef's kiss.
And he has this immediate thing like with Portia, where it's like there's genuine attraction there, I believe, but also like, could he be kind of working her while Quentin works her boss?
Is it an uncle-son sort of like, long con grift?
Exactly. And are the other European friends in on this whole thing? And, you know, because Jack says, like, oh, you know, the villa in Palermo is amazing. You'll have to come see it. It's always gay guys and, like, older hags.
Yeah.
You know, and
she's
he's
not
like,
really kind to Tanya, but...
Or... You would be the youngest woman there ever. Which, like, is like, so this might be a routine for them, or genuinely they just, like, appreciate a lady of a certain age who's kind of fun.
Okay, well, now I'm showing that maybe I'm like the gays that I said who just love character actresses. It did not even cross my mind that they would not genuinely want to spend time with Jennifer Coolidge, because who wouldn't want
right.
to genuinely spend time
right.
with Tanya? She is a trip. And I think that is, honestly, that is a dark but completely fair reading of it, and I could definitely see it going down that road. And the Tanya of it all, she's so self-concerned and so narcissistic that she wouldn't even know.
Right.
She would have no idea if she's getting conned.
Oh, no, absolutely not. And like the funny thing is that, you know, she's had scenes earlier in the season with Portia where she's like, no, don't go after unavailable men. Like Tanya knows from a bad man, but
yeah.
like she maybe in this case is like letting herself dare to believe, I mean, because it opened with like an out-of-nowhere compliment that she at first thought the guys looking at her across the dining room were, like, making fun of her. And
mm-hmm.
then she's like, wait, no, they're complimenting me? I never get complimented on my insane clothes. Like, I feel for her. I just worry that that the show has other plans.
Yeah.
It's for Tanya.
It's so funny because she says don't go for unavailable men, and now she's sort of being seduced by the most unavailable men,
exactly.
gay men,
right.
to her. But I, again, maybe this is my naive little heart speaking, but I feel like Mike White has too much love for Tanya, the character, and Jennifer Coolidge, the actress, to set her up so for such a demise.
Right, right. Yeah, I don't think that she's going to end up dead at the end of the season, but maybe this is maybe the kind of kicking off some whatever we're heading toward. A reader, or rather a listener, wrote in who knows tarot.
Mm-hmm.
And they said that actually, looking at the cards, they took a screenshot, that actually Tanya's cards were kind of good.
Yes,
and
okay.
suggested that she's going to get some agency and kind of like move on her own. So like, but that didn't seem to be how the tarot reader was reacting
yeah.
to the cards, so I don't
yeah.
know. I also wonder what any of this, if Quentin and Jack, his nephew, and these other guys actually turn out to be bad, what that means for Portia, because...
Mm-hmm.
I think you have, I mean, speaking of listener emails, a lot of people wrote into us over the last week about Albie.
Yeah, very worried about Portia and very skeptical and
yeah,
of Albie
yeah.
and his intent.
Like, is he one of those nice guys who's a bad guy, who's like incel-y, you know, kind of thing? I think certainly Mike White is aware of that like trope or phenomenon
yeah.
or whatever you want to call it. I kind of hope that it doesn't go that obvious route. Like, I think Albie certainly has certain aspects of that, and we see that play out in this episode where he's like,
we do.
Clearly,
His pride was wounded.
Yes, exactly.
He was absolutely, and I think for fair reason, he made a plan with Portia, who he's been crushing on. He has no reason to suspect or even know that, you know, Love Island hunk just came into the villa.
Right.
And that has completely...
Portia's at Casa Amor.
Yeah. He doesn't know that. And I want to say, shout out to the costumer, whoever decided to put Albie in truly like a child's oversized red shirt and like huge billabong shorts to confront Portia and Jack. He looked like a literal baby.
Yeah, a kid at summer camp.
A kid at summer camp dressed by his father, or and to have his dad, Dominic and Bert, and his grandpa walk up and interrupt the interaction. Just my empathy. Yeah. I feel like I have maybe too much empathy for Albie. Right now, I don't think that he's going to be some like killer incel person. I just think he's a young man who's growing into himself and honestly doesn't know how he's supposed to act with women because he wants to be appropriate, but he also wants to have sex and he's not confident. I just see him as an insecure man.
And he's overbearing in his way, you know, and not in the way that I think Portia thinks she wants. You know, you look at what Jack does and he's taking charge and he's got the sexy swagger and he makes the comment about his underwear and you'll see it later. And, you know, he kind of like when they're actually hooking up toward the end of the episode, at the very end of the episode, like he really is like kind of like taking charge and like Portia's clearly into that. This is her Sicilian adventure.
Yes.
And Albie just doesn't have that sort of mechanism.
He doesn't have that. Yeah. He wasn't born with it. What she says to Tanya at breakfast, he's not non-binary. That's the sort of the best thing that she can say about him.
Right.
That's the bar. And I don't think she meant that. I think Mike knew exactly what he was doing by using that sort of terminology and bringing in gender identity. I don't think that was meant to be sort of cruel to the LGBT community. Mike White's too smart for that. But it seemed to say that, she's, you know, not really attracted to him. That's that's basically what I got from that line.
Yeah. And hopefully it's as innocent as that. And, you know, because Albie has a new lady in his life, Lucia.
The meek will inherit the earth. And let's say that Albie comes through at the end. And I'm happy for him.
As Bert says, like father, like son. Because Bert seems very tickled by like keeping track of where Lucia and Mia are at any given moment and be like, oh, those are the girls. Like, you know, and he sees, you know, Mia topless in his room in this episode.
Bert knows all.
So we now have Mia and Lucia have touched on everyone now.
Just like about.
Every little group, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess not directly Portia and Tanya, but sort of.
Yeah. They're... It's funny because I was thinking about last season and the transactional nature and the classism in regards to the service employees and, you know, how they come and go. And Mia and Lucia are sort of trapped in their own way in the White Lotus. Like, they can't leave. If they leave, then they might never be able to come back. And they're just going from group to group, just whoever will take them.
Mm-hmm.
No home base, really. And they've now found a home base with Albie.
Do you think Lucia genuinely likes him?
Okay, I feel like I'm sounding so naive and so pie in the sky, head in the clouds this episode, but I do think she legitimately liked him.
I think they're about the same age.
Mm-hmm.
I think that what might be appealing to her compared to Cameron, or certainly Dominic. Dominic was nice to them.
Yeah.
Cameron, we see in this episode, like doesn't even have enough money.
Yeah.
Even though they told him up front last episode, this is going to be expensive.
Yes.
You know, Albie doesn't know. And so I think she's just kind of like, wait, so does this kid think that we're just having a conversation on the beach and I'm like a fellow hotel guest? Like, what a lark for her, you know, like that must feel so refreshing.
Yeah, I feel like, and we see this episode that she's struggling with the sort of Italian Catholic guilt about her profession and about being a sex worker. And she has aspirations to own a store and, you know, potentially leave that behind.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think that it was probably really refreshing and really lovely to just be Lucia and not be Lucia, you know, the sex worker, Lucia on the clock. And I do think she found him to be sort of naively adorable.
Yeah. I mean, I think half of the people I've talked to who watch the show are like, wait, Albie's so cute. I don't get why and why everyone isn't throwing themselves at him.
Exactly. And I think the shot with his butt at the very end will be trending on Twitter.
A certain corner of Twitter. the Jennifer Coolidge loving corner of Twitter, let's say.
They're going to eat that up.
I also think it was nice how, I mean, I don't know what it's like to come down from euphoric drugs, of course. I have no idea what that feels like.
Oh, yeah.
But I would imagine hypothetically that Mike White's like, oh, like Lucia would be feeling like shit, and not just physically, but like mentally.
Yes.
You know, she's like, I just did Molly or whatever it was, and now I'm kind of down in the dumps. And for whatever reason, Mia is like, no, whatever, come on, snap out of it. It's just the drugs talking. Like, you're fine. You're not going to get punished, you know?
She's empowered. Both of their brain chemistry has been altered from the drugs and from the experience. And Lucia is sort of on a downswing, sort of, you know, she's coming down from it. And Mia, you know, God bless her, she has sort of a revelation about what sex can do and how it can be used to literally be a means to an end and get what she wants.
Yeah, yeah. Which she tries to do with Giuseppe, the, you know, singer, piano player guy who has really, I guess, somewhat respectably just put it out on the table from like the get-go. He's like, look, if you sleep with me, I'll introduce you to my musician friends. We don't know yet if those friends exist, actually.
That is actually true, but that seems sort of like a tale as old as time in the music industry.
Right. But at least he's pointing to the casting couch and saying, this is the casting couch, you know?
Yes, he's being very clear about it.
Yeah. And, you know, we see, like, that the student has become the master now, and Mia's like, I'm going to go do it. And Lucia's kind of horrified.
Yeah, and Mia is actually a little bit too eager to do it to the point where she drugs him in multiple ways.
Uh-huh.
Speaking about, you know, Papa Molly, I'm sweating. Giuseppe learned the hard way.
Yeah, which did, I forget, did he take both pills?
He took both pills.
Which is like, your heart, that's not good for your heart.
I can't
imagine.
Good. That's a lot of blood rushing in a lot of different places. I feel like that's probably not good.
Yeah, even Cameron was smart enough to be like, we don't need Viagra.
Yeah,
I guess he didn't need it anyway.
Yeah,
but yeah, I'm curious where this is all going to go with Mia. I mean, obviously, like, more listeners wrote in and, you know, kind of agreed with both you and I, Chris, have had a theory over these episodes that, like, Mia and Lucia, unfortunately, are going to be the bodies in the water.
Yeah.
I think we are seeing these girls, like, at least Mia kind of veering into sort of maybe some dangerous territory. I mean, she almost killed someone.
Yeah. No, I mean, Giuseppe may be the first of the bodies.
Right.
We might have just gotten our first kill, y'all.
Yeah. And, like, Valentina is, I don't know where she is with Mia and Lucia, but like Valentina knows exactly who they are, and she, in some ways, I mean, now I'm going back to Survivor, but like she knows like what idols they have, and she's like, that's threatening to Mia and Lucia, you know, that like Valentina could at any time figure out a way to throw them out or get them in trouble.
Yes, there was an interesting reader listener theory that Valentina may have actually been a former sex worker herself.
And, oh yeah,
yeah, that somebody emailed, and I'm forgetting the name. That very well could be true, but she does seem to know the game they're playing quite well, but she's very preoccupied with her own burgeoning love story, or at least her affections for Isabella, and she gets her employee, and I'll say it, the ugliest starfish brooch I've ever seen in my entire life.
Yeah.
That feels out of character for her. It feels like she's acting in ways that she might not have ever acted before, which makes me think that maybe this is a new feeling and a new experience for her.
Yeah, it's awkward. Like I said, it's impersonal. She's like, here's pretty thing for pretty girl. Like, it's not like...
But I think she feels it's deeply personal. Like, it is
100%.
Impersonal, but it's deeply felt from her.
And I think that's, you know, we've seen that kind of pain on this show before, and really in a lot of Mike White's work as a whole, like that sort of problem of communication where someone is like, there's a whole like ocean roiling in them, and they kind of think the other person can hear it. And it's like, no, you have to like
express yourself.
Yeah. But I mean, again, you know, it's Valentina would be taking a risk there. But I think there's a nice parallel with her getting Isabella that starfish, and like Dominic, who's like, I went and bought jewelry for your mom and your sister. Like, won't that work? And it's like, why would you either, Valentina or Dominic, think that's like the trick, you know?
Yeah, even Albie is mature enough. And this is why I think I'm giving Albie more credit than some of our gorgeous listeners are. Even he's emotionally mature enough to realize that Dominic buying his mom gifts isn't going to save their family, and that what he's done is probably potentially irreversible. Right. Yeah. And so, I mean, Albie was already having a really tough spot. I mean, Albie is sort of the peaks and valleys of Albie this episode. Really wonderful. He had already sort of been rejected by Portia and for Jack. She chose Jack over him. And then he comes and sits down, and his dad is sort of shaming him for not wanting to get involved in fixing the problem that Dominic created. Albie had enough. And I was like, I'm proud of you, Albie, for saying that.
Except maybe now we can turn back to the Albie is bad theory, where it's like, okay, so he's got the simmering resentment towards his father and men like his father. And is Jack maybe in his eyes a man like his father, where it's like, uh-oh, you know, maybe Portia and Jack are in the water. I don't know.
That's actually such a good theory. Maybe it all becomes too much and he explodes.
Although I think the other thing to keep in mind with the White Lotus, I mean, I'm sure that Mike White doesn't want to exactly mirror last season, but the death last season was kind of an accident.
Yeah.
You know, and so maybe we're looking the wrong way when we're trying to find like the intentional killer, you know, maybe it's something kind of stupider and, you know, accidental than that.
Tanya slips and falls, you know. Right. Okay. Still Watching will be back in just a moment. And when we return, a conversation with Haley Lou Richardson and theories about who's dead.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, J. Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
I did want to go back and sort of talk about, I guess, one specific line between Mia and Giuseppe,
mm-hmm.
when they're in the rectory and she, and you know, they're having sex or they're just about to have sex. And I think it was sort of the thesis statement of the episode to me, and it came up in so many different ways. It's the part where Mia says, "Why do men have all the power?"
Mm-hmm.
And Giuseppe goes, "It's so that girls like you can skip the line and get to the front of the line."
Right.
And I was so struck by that because I was like, "Oh, that's a little like on the nose or a little, you know, maybe not the subtlest way of expressing that." But then to go back to sort of Quentin and his gay party, we literally see that exact dynamic play out at the like the party, the pool party, mm-hmm. with his queer friends. They hit on that guy, Mateo, right?
Yeah.
And they're like, "Oh, you're so cute. You're like, come to my gym." Like they have, you know, they have money. They've got, they're buying drinks or whatever. And then Mateo brings all his cute little Twinkie friends up to party. So it was, as much as it's a gendered dynamic, it really isn't a gendered dynamic.
Yeah.
And we see it both in terms of straight relationships and queer relationships. I thought it was so smartly and deftly thread throughout the episode.
Yeah. Yeah. I think certainly like what White, one of the things that White's doing in this season is looking at like the lives of the beautiful people, you know, and being like, how do these power dynamics work? And yes, it is pretty much all boiled down to sex, but like there's other stuff at work too, where it's like, you know, there's a certain status of being surrounded by, you know, good looking people or whatever.
There's
you
an
know?
Exchange. And if you're good looking, then you can exchange that for literal capital.
Right.
And literal, if money or drinks or status, we see that exchange. And it sort of goes back to Tanya and Quentin, because it's sort of unclear what that exchange might be.
Mm-hmm.
It, you know, she's rich, he's gay, but clearly there might be some sort of exchange there.
I mean, you know, I think also if we want to turn to some other people, like Cameron uses his good looks for power, you know, and sometimes he maybe takes it too far. We have both Cameron and Ethan waking up with like the world's worst hangovers, much like Lucia is experiencing maybe. But we also, we see them handle it in different ways. I think Cameron wakes up, he's like, "Oh, I feel like shit."
Well,
but
he's done this.
I'm Teflon. Like, you know, exactly.
He's done this before. Yeah. He's had this, he's woken up with the girls in the bed and they got to get out, and it's very, very normal for him, right? It's a lived in experience. Ethan, he's clearly, this is a new thing for him.
Yeah, it's new and he's like really having a hard time processing it. But I think he doesn't yet know. I don't think he's really processing much guilt because he didn't really do anything. He just like got too drunk and did drugs.
Yeah, well, he didn't really do anything until Harper gets back. And then he repeatedly lies by omission the entire live long day, which we got to talk about.
Well, yes. And it's because, you know, Cameron used the oldest trick in the book, which is like appeal to like male bonding and
bro code. Yeah, baby, bro code.
Sure, yeah, bro code.
Thank you. I love you. I just want to be inside you.
No, thank you.
Please.
No, ma'am.
I want to do stuff to you.
No.
I want to make you feel good.
The joke goes on like a little bit long enough that Ethan's kind of eyes open wider and he's like, "What is going on here?" You know, and I'm just like, that might just be Mike White kind of being funny, but like, I don't know, maybe there's something more there.
It's so couched in the fratty, like, oh, the funniest thing I could ever do is be gay, so let me be gay.
Right.
Like, it's couched in that humor. But there is this undercurrent, and they're at their big age, too. It's like, there might be something more there.
Yeah, yeah. At least on Cameron's side. But for the time being...
And Cameron is a sexual animal.
Cameron might be just sort of like pansexual,
yes, exactly.
Voracious.
I don't see him kicking many things out of the bed. That's what I imagine.
Right, right, right. Maybe some of Quentin's friends. Maybe the older ones.
Maybe the older ones.
But now he and Ethan are sort of bonded in this lie that Cameron is like no big deal and Ethan seems a bit more fraught by. So I guess my big question about the way that this plot line turns in this episode is, do you buy that Harper wouldn't say anything right away?
Okay, and this is where I want to get into Survivor with you.
Yeah.
So Harper finds Chekhov's condom wrapper.
Right, yeah.
Right, okay. And it honestly, it's such an important prop. And it's so, it was so good. And so for a while, I think Harper would be actually terrible at Survivor.
Yeah.
I think she'd be really bad at it because Aubrey Plaza is an actress. Harper is not an actress.
Right.
Harper, her resentment, she was basically dissociating the entire episode.
Oh, fully, catatonic.
She was completely not there and not present. And I do think, so while I think Harper would be a bad Survivor player because I don't think she has any social game or the ability to... charm or convince people of anything. I do think the lawyer jumped out in her. And I do think she's probably a great lawyer.
Yeah.
In that she has the evidence. She has everything that she needs. She has the condom wrapper. And she gave Ethan literally like 9 chances to just tell the truth and to explain what happened, knowing full well that she has, all the proof in her purse. So I do think from a lawyer perspective, I do think that she would actually give him 24 hours or give him some time to, set the record straight or address it or whatnot. And then we're due for a volcanic eruption quite soon from her.
Yeah, that really makes sense. I think that's a good way of putting it. And then she's given him another test, which is like, I'm going to put it on the bathroom counter and we'll see what he does with that.
Yeah.
Like, will he acknowledge it? Like, we'll have to find out next week. But like, what's a shame about that, the moment when she finds the condom wrapper, is just before that, Harper feels like she's had a little victory.
Oh, she's on top of the world, honey.
She's right. They cheat on each other. Well, she says he cheats on her, and I think she does too.
Mm-hmm.
And in that moment, before she finds the condom wrapper, I think she's like, see, babe, like, we're bonded. Like, we don't cheat on each other. We tell each other the truth
we're
about
so
everything.
We're so honest with each other.
And then just 2 seconds later, like, that whole premise collapses for her.
Yes. I am rooting for Harper.
Mm-hmm.
I think that she maybe flew a little too close with the sun with a, we're so much better than them there.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
She's, now she got burned.
Yeah, I mean, there have been moments... particularly talking about this difficult birth that Daphne went through, where, Cameron and her have been humanized as individuals, but also as a couple, where you're like, okay, they might be kind of monstrous, and Cameron certainly represents a monstrous industry, and Daphne is kind of shallow and a little bit bitchy sometimes, but they're actual people.
Yeah, they're
humans. And weirdly enough, it makes Harper seem like the meaner one, who's kind of, going home and spilling state secrets that Daphne had shared with her
immediately
upon getting back. So I'll be curious to see where that dynamic goes, because they now kind of all have something on each other in a way that they didn't before. And now it's out in the open that Cameron wants Ethan to invest.
Yeah.
And, both sides of the couples now know about infidelity of some kind or another. So, yeah.
I do think it needs to be said, too, not to... be anti Harper and Ethan, that Ethan literally didn't cheat on her. Like, he literally didn't have sex. That's not his condom. That was, or at least we're led to believe that is Cameron's condom.
Right.
We saw him in Lucia. So in some ways, Harper and Ethan's relationship is stronger or more honest than Cameron and Daphne's. But there was a really interesting listener letter that posited, I think a man named Nick sent it in. Thank you, Nick. That posited that maybe Cameron and Daphne are totally in on this whole entire thing, and they are sort of controlling. They planned for exactly what happened to happen, down to me and Lucia, down to Daphne whisking Harper away, and that they're in cahoots to, I don't know, get their money or something like that.
That's interesting.
So
maybe Quentin and Jack aren't the only maybe con people at the resort.
Maybe we have multiple con people. Maybe Cameron and Daphne are.
I mean, Cameron's whole industry is fucking con game. So
oh, I do want to talk about one other Cameron moment, read Giuseppe. So when Giuseppe, you know, has his Molly attack, or he sort of falls to the floor and it's like he's clearly like unwell. This was really funnily done, but also really depressing. Cameron just turns to the maitre d' and says, four, please, to sit down at dinner.
I know.
And I was like, oh, that is completely how that person would act in that situation. Like, complete. And everybody was sort of so unconcerned with Giuseppe in such a way. Bert made a joke like, oh, he's worse than usual tonight. And then Quentin walks by and he's like, well, maybe they'll get another one, a better one, now that Giuseppe is gone. So I'm trying to like keep a handle or a grasp on the classism and sort of that aspect of it. I think it is still, even though this season is so much about sex and relationships, we're still getting aspects of that.
So, Chris, I think we can't deny that Portia and Jack are the new it couple at the White Lotus Sicilia.
Yeah.
And you got to talk to one half of them, Haley Lou Richardson, who plays Portia.
Absolutely. I got to talk to Haley Lou Richardson this week about how Portia is living her best life this episode.
All of a sudden. Finally.
Of a sudden. Yeah. You know, from zero to hero. We love to see it.
Well, let's hear that now.
Hi.
Hi. Oh, my God. I gotta say, Haley Lou Richardson, I'm so happy to be talking to you and talking to you on Still Watching. I am so obsessed with Portia. She finally is getting her hot girl summer. She's gotten her adventure at the end of episode 4. She's living out loud, and she's having the adventure she's always wanted. How does she feel at the end of episode 4, do you think?
Oh yeah, that's the she gets to make out with a hot guy. He's not Italian. Yeah, he's British or whatever.
He's British. He's straight out of Love Island.
Yeah. Oh, which I literally have paused on my TV right there. I'm not even exaggerating.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Were you a Love Island fan before watching this? Before filming White Lotus season 2?
No, I think maybe Leo did it to me. Maybe Leo, like getting to know Leo subconsciously, made me want to watch a bunch of just like hot guys with British accents, like, I don't know, with their shirts off. But yeah, no, I really have it paused on my TV right there. But Portia,
that's
at the
really
end of
amazing.
Season or episode 4, yeah, I think she's starting to feel alive for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully she'll stop complaining, because I like looked up Portia on Twitter because I don't have a Twitter.
Yeah, you stole my next question. That's
oh, it
perfect.
Is? What was your next question?
Well, have you seen the memes about Portia crying because she's on an all-expenses-paid trip to Sicily?
Yeah, and then she's not allowed to do her job, but she's like stuck in. No, that was definitely, I mean, Mike knows what he's doing. He did that intentionally because it's so ironic and shitty, you know? So I'm glad. Yeah, I did look up Portia, and I tweeted, looked up my name, which I literally don't think I will ever do again.
Yeah, how was that?
Well, yeah, I mean, like, people after episode 3, like, seem to be pretty annoyed with Portia and me as an actor.
That's crazy when they mix up the two.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess maybe it's because I'm just doing Portia so good. I don't know. But
that's it.
But yeah, is that it? Anyways,
I think that's it.
Hopefully they'll stop being, maybe she'll become hopefully a little less annoying because she stops complaining, because she just starts making out with a hot guy, right?
Yeah, but you know what? I'm going to defend Portia and you by proxy. All right?
Please.
She's been dropped in Sicily and she's having this amazing vacation and it's fantastic. But clearly, like, she's just coming out of a pandemic. She's lost. She's working for Tanya, who cannot be an easy boss. I think she has a lot of reasons to feel frustrated with the situation. She's supposed to be, you know, right by Jennifer Coolidge's side, but also completely anonymous and completely away. So it's like, how I understand why Portia is stressed and having a difficult time navigating her relationship with Tanya. Can you tell me about, like, does Portia love Tanya? Like, are they friends? Is she a good boss? What do you think about that employee and employer relationship?
Well, first of all, thank you for coming to our defense.
I will. I ride for Portia.
Okay. I really, really appreciate that. But yeah, I think the Tanya and Portia relationship and dynamic is actually kind of dark, because I think that, you know, like in the first episode and me, when I kind of just like
you know, got the audition and the character description and had like this basic kind of image of what this character was going to be in this dynamic and everything with Tanya, I was like, oh, she's going to be like, Tanya's going to be a nightmare and Portia's just going to be this like relatable, just like frazzled assistant. And I think that, you know, as the episodes go on, you really see just like the angst and the misery and the bit of like kind of narcissism and just like unawareness and lostness that Portia has that almost kind of is like a mini Tanya. Like, I really do feel like, and we talked about this, me and Mike talked about this, of like, if Portia doesn't get her shit together, like, she could end up just as like the broke, not billionaire version of Tanya. You know?
Wow. That is harrowing.
I know,
to imagine.
It's dark.
I've never. That is really dark. It's a mini me, like Portia as Tanya's mini me, is sort of crazy, and it does like, because I from watching this season, I was like, I wonder how Portia and Tanya got connected, you know, because they sort of seem, and the way that Portia acts, they seem like they're, you know, very different, different women. Portia has her head on her shoulders in many ways. She's self-aware, you know. She's lost,
Portia self-aware? I think she has like,
okay, let's talk about it.
I think that Portia has like, and I relate to this because I have been stuck here before and I might still be in my life. Like, I feel like she's in that place that like, I think a lot of young people honestly are in, where like, they think they know everything. But really, they're just like, they have this kind of expectation and judgment on like all the things around them and this hyper awareness for everybody around them. Mm-hmm. And like, and also this like, this like intense expectation from everything else and everybody else because of putting all the awareness and responsibility on that. And then Portia, I don't think is capable at this point in her life, like so far what we've seen in the show, to like look inward and actually see that she is part of her, like she is her own problem in so many ways. Wow. I think she has this like fake self-awareness that's
wow.
And I can say this because I relate.
Well, I think that's so great in terms of her projecting and her thinking everything else is a problem. She's sitting in Sicily and she's like, there's no adventure. You can't get lost anymore. You know, everyone's on their phones. And she's also part of the problem. It's me. Hi,
it's me.
I'm the problem. It's me. It's Portia.
I teach a dance class to old people. And I'm actually doing it today too. But today and last Wednesday, I'm doing the dance to Antihero.
To Antihero.
And it's a great dance.
That is actually... One, I would love to take that dance class. Gonna take that dance class one day. That's fantastic. Two, Portia is the anti-hero.
Taylor
Portia might be
wrote this song for Portia.
Oh my gosh. I'm having a mind-blowing moment.
That's her anthem.
That's her anthem. And is that why, and I've got to say, maybe this is crazy at this point, but is that why she can't connect with Albie? I'm still rooting for Portia and Albie. I still want them figure it out. Am I crazy?
No, I think that's really sweet. I love your perspective on all of this so far. You have empathy for Portia and you like her and Albie together. No, I like this. No, I do think that in another world, well, in this world, Albie could be so great for Portia in so many ways, but she would also just ruin him. And there would be so much just resentment there because they're, I think Portia's just not able to, I don't know. Honestly, it's weird because Portia's so lost and having this like quarter life crisis. And it's strange because normally I can describe and talk about characters I play like so acutely. And with Portia, it's like my brain like blows up and is all over the map. And I think it's just because that's what she's like to me.
Well, and I think that's because Mike White, I mean, credit to him, he wrote such a nuanced, complicated character where you like, you can be rooting for her, but also notice that, yeah, she's self-aware, but is that even real? Is that fake self-awareness? And for me, the reason why I think I'm rooting for Portia and Albie a little bit, even though it's clear that she's not that into him and it's a little bit of a nice guy's finish last situation, mm-hmm. it seems, is that I did feel that they could both learn something from each other. Like, Portia is trying to sort of teach Albie to get out of the shell and to sort of be a little bit more forthcoming and go for what he wants. And Portia could maybe learn from Albie to look inward and maybe like be a little bit more interior and not necessarily as gung-ho. Maybe I'm wrong.
No, I think you're right. I think that on paper, it's kind of like that. But then if you actually imagine them, like, after this vacation trying to date and, like, if you actually imagine that, it would just be a mess, I think. I think it would just, mm-hmm. I really do think Portia would ruin him. And I think that she would just, I don't know. But I do love your hope.
But I also so understand that sometimes a guy walks in the pool and he's so hot that you lose all sense of yourself. And you can't focus on what's in front of you. And that's what happened when Jack comes in the pool in his red trunks the episode prior and Portia sees him. So I understand when that walks in,
when Love Island comes to the villa. When a bombshell walks in. Jack is a bombshell on Love Island. I definitely think Jack is like the opposite of Albie, obviously. Yeah, it's just, but I also think that shows just like how not grounded and kind of self-serving like Portia's true mindset is right now, is that she can just like, but you know, sometimes you have to be that way in life. It's, everyone's on their own journey, but yeah.
Do you think that Portia and Jack would, you know, work better in real life than Portia and Albie? Like, do you think that has more potential to grow?
No, I think that all of these options for Portia right now are unhealthy. I think that she needs to spend some time alone and get a therapist. I think that's what she really needs. I think Portia would ruin Albie, and I think Jack would ruin Portia.
Wow. Wow. Okay. That's the spectrum. That's the dichotomy. Well, speaking of therapists, Tanya does try to give her some kind of sage advice about not, you know, going after unavailable men. Should she be listening to Tanya more? Do you think that's, or, you know?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting thing that I remember thinking while we were filming, is there are these little moments where Tanya and Portia do kind of connect, or where like Tanya is at, or Portia, oh, wow, I'm getting them confused. Portia, Portia's like actually taking what Tanya's saying to heart, or like, Portia is kind of confiding in Tanya, and like there's almost like this little bit of like friendship or like bonding almost. And I remember thinking that was so interesting while we were filming it. Those moments, they felt so like unexpected of actual connecting or whatever. But yeah, since Portia could very well end up being Tanya, but just broke, I do think she should. If she had true awareness and self-awareness, she could look at this woman and be like, take it as like a warning sign, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. Cautionary tale. I gotta know. You said during filming, what's it like to act opposite Jennifer Coolidge, and to sort of, is it intimidating? Did you feel like you learned something? That feels like such an amazing opportunity and unbelievable.
Yeah, it was an amazing opportunity. I feel like, I don't think I was intimidated, but I was like observing constantly. And I think there's so many times with the two of them where Tanya's really leading the scene and having some problem and are going off about something, and Portia's just like watching or like reacting.
Yeah.
And I feel like with anyone else, that would have been like with any other actor and any other character, that could have been really unfulfilling for me as an actor to just like be along for the ride.
Yeah.
But because it's Jennifer, Coolidge, and because it's Tanya, this like truly another one of her iconic characters, I think, that she's brought to life. I really just, it was genuinely fulfilling and like interesting, and I learned a lot just to like be there and observe her and, you know, and kind of react to it. So yeah, it was cool. And also I felt really lucky because she's only one, and John, but they're the only ones from the first season, and the tone of the show is so specific and important, and I really wanted to like understand how I could fit into that with just what I would instinctively bring to this character. And since so many of my scenes are with Jennifer, and like my first week I was just working with Jennifer a bunch, I felt like I immediately like got understood the tone of the show, because she kind of is the tone of the show. So yeah, I just felt, I felt really lucky with that, because it made me kind of like finding my place in all of that easier.
Wow. That's so cool. That's such, you guys do beautiful work with each other. Really. It's funny. It's devastating. It's really fantastic. I gotta know, sort of to close out, do you have anything for the Portia haters out there on Twitter scrolling through, or what, do you have anything to say to them?
Well, honestly, I understand. I agree. Like this is intentional, you know, like she is supposed to, I think the word I saw the most when I was like scrolling through Portia tweets was insufferable. And I'm like, I get it, because it's also sneaky. It's like in the first episode, or maybe the first two episodes, you're like, oh, this person's so relatable. Like she's like the only one who's not some rich asshole on this. You know what I mean? Like, oh yeah, we can understand. But then it's like so much of that, like complaining and lostness and angst and desperation and like misery and pity, like self-pity. And like, while I have so much empathy and care for Portia, because, you know, I had to for 5 months doing the show, I always knew, and Mike and I always knew, that that was the point. Like there is not one character on this show that is safe from being insufferable in some type of way, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. Or flawed in some type of way. Yeah, deeply flawed in some type of way. Deeply. And, you know, I'm a Portia stan, and I think she's not insufferable. I just think she's lost. And if we get her a good therapist, she could do great things one day.
She could share mine. Yeah, her and Christy would get along, I think. But
let's get Christy on the line.
Let's tell Christy in. But yeah, no, I always thought that about her. I was like, she needs a therapist. And every time, because I was talking to my therapist throughout shooting, you know, over Zoom and everything, and I'd be like, God, Portia needs this. Portia needs this.
Wow.
Yeah.
God, that's so wonderful. Wow. Haley, this has been so fun. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you, Haley. Really appreciate it. Bye.
All right, Chris, now it's time for the most important segment of this and every episode of Still Watching the White Lotus. Who do we think is dead? Before we offer our ideas, we should turn to some listeners who wrote in. I believe we already mentioned this earlier in the episode, but just to reiterate, a listener named Miles wrote in and said, the hotel concierge, which I guess it means Isabella or Valentina. I think they mean Valentina.
I would say Valentina.
Kills someone, literally anyone, but probably the prostitutes. We've seen what limited joy she has in her life, only happy when feeding two adorable kittens, and she's going to snap. Although she does have a new potential happiness in her life with Isabella, although Isabella is not.
Isabella does not seem to reciprocate, but...
But I like that theory.
I do like that theory. I do think Valentina is capable of murder, if that supports your theory.
And Hannah in Italy, who has written in before, I believe, she says, ciao, Anna, come stai? I am worried that the mention of the word incel does not bode well for Portia. I am afraid her rejection of Albie in favor of hot pool boy Jack may end badly, and Albie may be protesting too much to his father and grandfather. The fortune teller was also predicting murder, thought Though it wasn't clear to me whose murder she was predicting. But when Portia said, I thought I'd get a reading, I got worried for her.
Oh, that's a really good point that I thought I got a reading. I thought I would get a reading. Again, now that Albie is in the loving arms of Lucia, it makes me think that maybe he won't resort to murder. But again, as Richard said earlier, tensions are rising. He's been through a lot this vacation.
Okay. We've stalled long enough. We now have to put our own chips on the table. I think after watching this episode, my new theory is that the dead person is, well, I'm going to cheat a little bit. Okay. Quentin and someone else.
Okay. Yeah, tell me about.
I don't know who. I just think that if they are scamming Tanya, mm-hmm. I think the show and Mike White has enough affection for Tanya to let her win in the end a little bit, which means somehow by some accident, Quentin is the one. Maybe they go visit the island villa and he trips and falls or something happens. Or maybe she pushes him but gets away with it.
Yeah.
And he dies. But I don't know who the other body or bodies would be.
Okay. Could it be the French actor who's on Emily in Paris named Bruno Guri?
Right. Yes. I think
hair?
That's right.
It could be him. Just shout out. I was obsessed that he's in it. It's so great. That actually is a very interesting, because to be brought on so late.
Yeah.
We're halfway through the season now, so it feels like something big. Quentin has to have been brought in for a reason, more than just being, Tanya's gay best friend.
Right. And don't you think it would make some sense to, have two seasons of The White Lotus be building to Tanya killing a man for all of men's sins?
Yeah, that would be, there's something really beautiful about that, honestly.
And we also keep hearing we keep seeing the heads, the statuary stuff and the story about that where she cut off, the guy's head because he cheated on her or whatever. So maybe we're going to get a woman on man crime.
Well, that's exactly where my brain went, but I didn't go for Tanya killing Quentin. I went for Harper killing Ethan. I feel like the way that she, or Harper killing maybe multiple people.
Harper goes on a rampage.
Harper rampage. The way that Harper dissociated this episode and how painful and how upset she was, even at the thought, the prospect of, her imagination was running wild with what Ethan might have done. I could see her seeking revenge either potentially. I mean, I think she loves Ethan, obviously. But I don't know, a scorned woman, things can go left real quick. So, clearly she doesn't kill Daphne, but.
Right, that's all we know.
Maybe.
And Valentina.
And Rocco.
But that's it. There are a lot of other people that could be dead at her hand.
Maybe Harper kills Mia and Lucia. Maybe it's Ethan. Maybe it's Cameron. I don't know. Something really shifted in Harper this week that made me afraid of her and what she's capable of.
Well, if you agree, disagree, have alternate theories, please do write us at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. We love hearing from you. And, it really adds to the sort of viewer experience, I think, and the podcast experience to have input from other people. So please, again, that's stillwatchingpod@gmail.com.
Yes.
So that's it for this week's episode. You can, again, email us at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com with theories about the show, critiques. If you have any Italian extra knowledge you want to share.
Tarot knowledge.
Thank you. We always appreciate that.
All of the above.
If you don't want to email, you can always find us on Twitter. I'm at Rylas, which is R-I-L-A-W-S.
And I'm at Christress, which is C-H-R-I-S-T-R-E-S-S.
This has been Still Watching from Vanity Fair. Our editor and producer is Dave Gonzalez, and we had production help from Peyton Hayes and Katie Rich. We had technical assistance from Scott Lee. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer, and our theme music is by Alexis Quadrado. We'll be back next week for episode 5. Looking forward to seeing you then.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then, I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now. From PRX.